Welcome back to this lecture on the biblical flood. 2 Peter 3, verse 3 to 7. Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts, and saying, "Where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. For this they are willingly ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth which are now, by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." Verses 5 and 6 in the New Living Translation reads as follows: "They deliberately forget that God made the heavens long ago by the word of his command, and he brought the earth out from the water and surrounded it with water. Then he used the water to destroy the ancient world with a mighty flood." Now, the flood took place around 2,500 years BC and lasted for approximately 1 year. This is confirmed in the word of God, while nature provides clear evidence testifying to this fact. So was it a local or was it a worldwide flood? If it was a local flood, why didn't God simply instruct Noah to move further away to a high-lying mountainous area somewhere? Why did he have to take birds on the ark? They could have just flown away. But more importantly, although God judged the world by a flood, he also promised that this will never occur on a worldwide scale again. And as a sign of his promise, he gave us the rainbow. Although there have been numerous local floods since the time of Noah, there has never, ever been another worldwide one. If the biblical flood was only a local flood, that would mean that God has broken his promise over and over again to never again send a flood such as in the days of Noah. And God never breaks his promises. Just as the fossils remind us that God once destroyed the earth with a worldwide flood, so the rainbow after the rains remind us that he will never do so again. There are at least 500 legends worldwide which are remarkably similar in details to the flood in Noah's time as described in the Bible. In 1960, the Old Testament theologian Dr. John Whitcomb and the late hydrological engineer Dr. Henry Morris published the Genesis flood. There has never before or since been a single piece of work that was so effective in encouraging Christians to believe in the divinely inspired scientific accuracy and authority of the Bible. The Genesis flood challenged the atheistic ideas of evolution, namely long ages. By effectively combining what the Bible teaches with scientific data, including hydrology, geology, and archaeology, Whitcomb and Morris's work confirmed that the biblical text describing a recent worldwide flood, not a limited local flood without much impact, was true. They further indicated how the existence of the geologic column is hereby explained. While we are now talking about the flood, keep in mind once again that none of us were there, which is why we need to draw conclusions regarding the circumstances before the flood by looking at fossils and landscapes and by comparing that to the biblical revelation. Now, some creation scientists have proposed that there used to be a thick water vapor canopy, a column, around the earth. However, a lot of research has been done on this, and if it were true, this canopy could never have been thicker than 2 meters, since this would have caused the temperature on Earth to be far too hot due to the greenhouse effect of carbon dioxide, which prevents warm air from leaving the Earth. Most creation scientists today have rejected the idea of a thick water vapor canopy. It appears as if the climate before the flood was nice and warm all the way from the North Pole to the South Pole, mainly due to more ground surface, since deserts, glaciers, ice caps, and the associated higher sea levels probably didn't exist before the flood. more ground surface provides space for the growth of a much larger number of plants, which again resulted in a higher percentage of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The total amount of carbon locked into the fossils in Earth's crust is at least 100 times more than the carbon present in the biosphere today. The biosphere is the air and the sea and the lakes, rivers, soils, plants and animals. But why? Because of the burial of billions of organisms during the flood. The warm climate is also confirmed by the type of plant fossils present today all around the world, even in the northern and southern parts, as well as under Antarctica's ice caps, where coal seams have been discovered. These coal seams contain plants which don't grow in the polar regions today, but only in warmer parts. The fossils provide us with a photo of the life that existed on Earth the day that Noah went into the ark. It reveals a pre-flood world that was very green and moist and absolutely teeming with plants and animals. Very likely only broad rivers and small shallow seas existed. Before the flood, most of the water was probably located at a depth of 10 to 20 kilometers beneath Earth's crust, where there is still a lot of water present today. Dinosaurs were alive, but most of the larger ones were vegetarian. They were herbivores. And most of the violent ones probably spent all of their time hunting these herbivores. However it may be, the sin of man affected the whole world very negatively. Before the flood, everything ate plants, not each other. Genesis 7:11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. Now this sentence contains a lot of information. God's word describes how he caused the dry land to come forth out of the water on the third day. A certain amount of the water that initially covered the earth was probably trapped in and under the dry land in the process. Geologists have calculated that the rocks in Earth's mantle still contain enough water in their mineral structure to fill up the oceans 10 times over. Genesis 7:11 describes how the fountains of the deep were broken up. This implies a release of water, probably through huge cracks in the earth's surface, as well as water welling up over the dry land. The fact that the fountains are mentioned first is probably an indication that the most important source of water came from under Earth's crust. If this was the case, it must have been an enormous source of water. These fountains did not stop squirting water until a full 150 days, in other words, 5 months of the flood ran its course. The surface of the earth tore open, for example, where we find the mid-oceanic ridge, whereby millions of liters of water were injected into the air and spilled over Earth's surface. This ridge was discovered in the 1950s. It follows a huge circular route around the Earth to form the world's longest mountain range of 74,030 kilometers. The part of this mountain range in the Atlantic Ocean is named the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and it extends from north to south. Now, from the third creation day up until the flood, the Earth's surface looked rather different than today, probably with one huge supercontinent. Genesis 1:9, God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place and let the dry ground appear." Now, before the 1960s, most geologists believed that the continents were stationary. Those that promoted the idea of moving continents were accused of indulging in pseudoscientific fantasy. The Earth's surface consists of a mosaic of rigid plates, each moving relative to the other plates. The creationist Antonio Snyder was the first to propose the catastrophic horizontal movement of the continents. In other words, they're breaking up and drifting apart during the flood. In 1858, he made these two maps depicting his interpretation of how the American and African continents may once have fit together before subsequently becoming separated. The fit of the continents, taking into account the continental shelves, is one of the four evidences used in support of continental drift. Also, the correlation of fossil types across ocean basins provide evidence in support of continental drift. A zebra stripe pattern of magnetic reversals, which form parallel to mid-oceanic floor rifts in the volcanic rock, was recorded in many areas, which implies seafloor spreading along the rifts. Now, seafloor spreading happens along mid-ocean ridges, such as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, when molten material from the mantle rises up in the gap between the plates, cooling to form new crust under the ocean. At the time of cooling, some of the rock's minerals acquire magnetism from the Earth's magnetic field, recording the field's direction at the time. This happened as the new ocean floor was created and the continents were pulling apart. Interestingly, plate tectonics was introduced by a creationist long before it was ever considered by evolutionists, and today it is accepted by most mainstream secular scientists. Yet they refuse to acknowledge that creationists are true scientists. The current theory that incorporates seafloor spreading and continental drift is known as plate tectonics. The creationist Dr. Baumgartner, working at Los Alamos National Laboratory in the USA, used supercomputers to do all the relevant calculations, and he is actually credited with developing the best 3D supercomputer model of plate tectonics. The model has been independently duplicated and verified by others, and according to Dr. Baumgartner, the cold, dense, and therefore heavy ocean floor, heavier than the continents, began to sink into the less dense mantle beneath. This created friction, which generated heat in some parts of the mantle, especially around the edges of the sinking floor. The heat softened the adjacent mantle material, making it less resistant to the sinking of the ocean floor. In other words, it lowered the viscosity so that the edges of the plate started sinking faster into the mantle, dragging the rest of the ocean floor along in a conveyor belt fashion. The faster movement created more friction and more heat in the surrounding mantle material, reducing its resistance even further, and so the ocean floor moved and sank even faster, peaking at a speed of meters per second rather than millimeters per year, the speed at which plates are moving today. Now, at that speed, the sinking plates could have reached the bottom of the mantle, which is about 2,900 kilometers below the surface, in 15 days. It was more like a tectonic sprint than tectonic drift, which is why it's called runaway subduction. Interestingly, seismic observations, a sort of CAT scan of the inner planet, provided evidence that there are slabs of rock the size of continents and colder than the surrounding mantle material at the bottom of the mantle. It could not have been there for too long, otherwise it would have totally been melted and mixed beyond recognition with the surrounding mantle material. Now, as the ocean floor sank and rapidly subducted adjacent to the pre-flood supercontinent's margin, elsewhere, the Earth's crust would have been under such immense tensional stress that it would be torn apart, rifted, thereby breaking up the pre-flood supercontinent and the ocean floor as well, creating rapid extending crustal spreading zones along cracks in the ocean floor. Hot mantle material displaced by the subducting slabs would well up and rise to the surface along these spreading zones, so the new ocean floor was dramatically hotter, especially in its upper 100 kilometers. This caused the ocean floor to rise 1 to 2 kilometers higher than before and implies a dramatic rise in the global sea level. This higher sea level floods the continental surface, laying down large areas of sedimentary deposits on top of the continents. As the ocean floor cooled, it sank into the mantle, resulting in further catastrophic vertical movements. Now, as the plates were being pulled into the mantle by gravity, there was a circulation, a stirring, or a large-scale displacement of semi-solid mantle material going on, as indicated by the white arrows in the figure. Circulating cooling material down to the core, or the mantle boundary, just above the liquid core, and as the convection increased, it would have increased heat loss from the core, producing a flipping of the Earth's magnetic field in the solid core. And as mentioned earlier, these magnetic reversals were recorded in the new ocean floor as it was being produced. The new, very hot ocean floor formed by molten rock from the mantle would have evaporated enormous amounts of ocean water into steam, producing a linear geyser of superheated steam along the whole length of the various rifts. Genesis 7:11, "And the windows of heaven were opened, and this water fell down on the earth." We already know that a reduced water canopy of 2 meters or less around the earth could not have made a significant contribution to the 40 days and nights of rainfall. Atmospheric water alone could not have been the only source of water for the flood. The molten rock, which evaporated copious amounts of water, formed superheated steam, which would have dispersed, condensing in the atmosphere to cause intense global rainfall, and this could account for the 40 days and nights of rainfall, persistent rainfall. The mechanism proposed by the catastrophic plate tectonics model supplies an extremely reliable explanation for various mechanisms operating during the flood. There was also another type of fountain that broke open at this time, the reservoir of the underground molten rock or magma. There are many volcanic rocks found scattered in between the fossil-bearing sedimentary strata. It is therefore very likely that this breaking up of the fountains also included a series of volcanic eruptions, and that the volcanic rock layers were laid down in between the sedimentary layers during the flood event. Large amounts of water were released from beneath the surface in the process. Up to 70% of what is released from a volcano is actually water in the form of steam. An estimated 60,000 seamounts occur on the seafloor, and seamounts are suboceanic extinct volcanoes. Violent storms occurred, and the water level continued to rise. Vast mats of vegetation, volcanic fire, and lava all worked together to create utter chaos and mayhem. Fast-flowing water, powerful turbulence, and massive back-and-forth wave actions resulted in the deposition of sedimentary layers. Fossils provide evidence of a disastrous catastrophic event and a rapid burial. If it is true that the sedimentary layers and the fossils were formed due to the flood, we should be able to observe the following. The relatively simple single-cell organisms which still occur in the deep rock layers today should be widespread mainly in rocks dated as Precambrian. These include organisms such as bacteria and algae that form stromatolites, as well as other microscopic fossils, traces of fossils, and fossil remains such as graphite. Hydrodynamic sorting would cause smaller, denser organisms with a low buoyancy to be buried first, since they will settle out of the sediments faster, while those with high buoyancy, or the floaters, may not have been buried at all. Animals that lived in the lower strata or layers, for example the marine invertebrates on the sea bottom, should mainly, but not exclusively, be buried there. Since the flood began in the sea, when the fountains of the deep burst forth, we would expect enormous amounts of muddy sediments and marine invertebrates to be ripped up by the turbulent waters. As the flood waters inundated the continents, huge numbers of these shallow marine invertebrates were buried on the continents in rapid succession. Marine and other water plants will generally occur lower than swamp vegetation, which again will occur lower than mountainous vegetation. Fish fossils should be widespread, but generally lower than amphibians and reptiles. Animals that lived in the same area should be buried together. Because many animals group together, especially when threatened, fossilized animal groups should occur buried together. Differential escape means that the stronger and smarter, more mobile and endothermic animals, organisms, should be buried later in the fossil record. For example, since land vertebrates are more mobile and able to sense danger, causing them to flee from the rising water, they should generally be buried last. Their fossilized tracks, which is often a testimony of how they fled, should occur in the lower layers. As the waters rushed over the continents, different ecological zones at different elevations were progressively formed and inundated. Relatively few fossils of birds, mammals, and humans should be present, since they would have fled to the highest parts, as mentioned. Some would have tried to remain afloat by clinging to driftwood, and eventually they would have drowned due to exhaustion. When the end came, they would not have been buried under sediments, but they would sink to the ocean floor, the upper part of the sediment layers, where they would eventually decompose and disappear. Now, this is exactly what has been discovered thus far in the fossil record. Hundreds of human fossils have been discovered, but mostly in sedimentary strata laid down after the flood. For example, they were buried in caves during the ice age that occurred after the flood. It is clear that the fossil record is not a representation of the progressive natural history of life on Earth, but rather an indication of a global burial of plants and animals in their respective ecological zones during the flood. Since it is very unlikely that fossil patterns produced by a global catastrophic flood could be explained by a single mechanism, differing combinations of factors such as differential escape, ecological zonation, hydrodynamic sorting, as well as simple chance, are used to explain stratigraphic differentiation in the fossil record. Now, looking at the fossil record again, we see that the Paleozoic era at the bottom is characterized by an abundance of shallow marine invertebrates, such as trilobites and especially their tunnels, as well as brachiopods, which were buried in the Cambrian sediments. Trilobites are also found in the Ordovician, together with several other marine organisms, such as sea lilies. We also find unusual land plants, jawless fish, bony fish, and sharks. As the silt and sediment-laden floodwaters inundated the continental areas, land plants together with a variety of amphibian and reptile tracks were covered and buried by sediments. Coal forests, seed ferns, extinct giant horsetails, amphibians, and clams were buried in the sediments of the Carboniferous period, while even more fish, amphibians, and reptiles were buried in the Permian sediments. Let's now have a look at the Mesozoic era. The fossils of reptiles and more amphibians in the Triassic sediments clearly show how they were buried higher in the fossil record than where their tracks were first observed. Conifers and seed ferns, which still occur today, also occur here. Cycads, conifers, dinosaurs, and other reptiles were buried in the Jurassic sediments. Now, by this time, the storms became so violent that some animals were thrown together in groups, forming fossil graveyards. Eventually, the Cretaceous sediments buried the last reptiles as well as the first mammals and flowering plants. This period is characterized by extensive limestone deposits and massive extinctions worldwide. Fossilized ripple marks and tracks of land animals are widespread in this area. The Cenozoic area is characterized by fossil birds and mammals, as well as enormous numbers of insects and even more fish. Very few fossils of humans, monkeys, and birds are present in this era, as explained before. Read with me. Fossil ranges are regularly extended downward. Vertebrates such as fish and reptiles have been pushed back into the Cambrian. Sharks have been pushed back 25 million years to the Upper Ordovician. Vascular plants have also been pushed back 25 million years, while flying insects were pushed back 80 million years to the Lower Silurian. This implies that the supposed origin of the first land plants, which insects depend on, should be pushed back even further into the Ordovician. Fossil stromatolites have now been identified in rocks from all evolutionary time periods in the geologic column. As mentioned earlier, fossils are indicative of a disaster and rapid burial. When a fish dies today, why doesn't it change into a fossil? Instead, it blows up, floats for a while, and eventually sinks down below where scavengers get a hold of it and you just see scales flying. So it floats, bloats, rots, and falls apart. Basically, nothing is left of it in the end. Let's use an example of a larger animal. Where are all the bisons today? Most of them were hunted to almost extinction a mere 100 years ago. Where are their carcasses? The carcasses that were spread over the American plains in their uncountable millions only two generations ago, and they barely left a trace. The meat was eaten and even the skeletons disappeared. It should be quite clear that their size has nothing to do with the fact that they didn't fossilize. There is an excess of fossilized plants in the strata. Yet today, when a plant dies, even a baobab, it simply turns back into dust over time. Why doesn't the plant fossilize? It takes very special conditions for fossilization to take place. And what's more, even though we've literally discovered billions of fossils in the sedimentary strata, they are never again formed in the present on this magnitude. What we need is a rapid death, a rapid burial, and high pressure to enable sealing. So how fast is fast really? Are we talking months, weeks, days, seconds? A clear fossil of an extinct marine reptile called the ichthyosaur was discovered. Unfortunately, I was unable to obtain permission to use the photo in this series, but you can Google ichthyosaur giving birth. This is a fossil of a mother who has almost finished giving birth to her little bambino. Only the mouth of the baby is still in the mother's birth canal. It's clear that both of them were suddenly overwhelmed and buried very rapidly during the flood. It must have happened rapidly, otherwise both would have rotted or been eaten by scavengers. The other option, if evolution is true, is that this mother lay on the ocean floor for thousands of years giving birth to a bambino, while the sediment slowly covered them and they eventually fossilized without decaying or being scavenged. You choose which lenses you want to have on for this one. There has even been a discovery of a fossil fish swallowing another fish. With its mouth full of food, this fish and its meal were squished flat like a pancake. Only the meal fish's tail was still sticking out for decoration, or just maybe so that we could clearly see this evidence for what it is. Clearly, it must have been a very sudden and rapid event if we are able to observe one fossil fish swallowing another. Now, how long do you think a jellyfish can remain intact after dying? It takes little more than a day for it to start melting away in the sun or for scavengers to get a hold of it. It has no skeleton or hard body parts, and according to geologists, fossilized imprints of jellyfish and most other soft-bodied organisms are extremely rare and unusual. Even Darwin thought that no organism wholly soft can be preserved. Yet they discovered fossils of hundreds of jellyfish that are exquisitely preserved, many specimens measuring over 50 centimeters across, and these are the biggest jellyfish fossils that we know of. News reports said that they were stranded by a freakish tide and storm on an ancient beach and was later buried in sand due to repetitive storms to form these fossils. Now, not only is finding a huge deposit of these soft-bodied organisms very rare, but finding them in sandstone is quite remarkable, since jellyfish buried in sand break down and decompose faster because oxygen filters freely through the interconnected air spaces between the grains, contributing to rapid decay. With a thumb-sucked age of 500 billion years, these jellyfish apparently lived long before land animals and birds evolved. In The New Scientist, it is explained how the absence of these predators, which could prey on them, caused them to remain stranded until they were buried by subsequent storms, yet without any signs of decay or drying out. The evidence, however, clearly supports the fact that the jellyfish were not scavenged because they were rapidly covered by sediments. They did not dry out because they were buried while continuously underwater, and they didn't rot or decay because catastrophic burial in water and sand would have led to stagnation. In other words, anaerobic conditions. It is well known that anaerobic conditions and relatively constant cool temperatures are known to retard decay. Giant fossilized oysters of up to 3.5 meters in size and weighing 300 kilograms have been discovered in the fossil record. The most interesting aspect, however, is not only their size, but rather where they were discovered, and that is high up on the Andes Mountains. Approximately 500 of these giant fossilized oysters have been discovered at an altitude of 4,000 meters above sea level in Peru. But how could oysters have lived up there? Evolutionists believe that these oysters are from the Jurassic period, making them 200 million years old. They further believe that the Andes Mountains were slowly uplifted since that time due to a plate under the Pacific Ocean colliding with the South American plate, pushing the latter upwards. There is, however, a serious problem with this old age for the oyster fossils. The rate of erosion is faster than the rate of lift. In fact, the Andes, which is about 4,000 meters above sea level, would have eroded flat within a mere 56 million years if the uniformitarian principle regarding the rate of erosion is applied. Yet, evolutionists declare that these oysters on top of the Andes is 200 million years old. Simply put, if the Andes Mountains were really that old, and considering the current rate of erosion, it would not be there anymore. This evolutionary problem is, however, not only limited to the Andes Mountains. All around the world, we encounter marine fossils in the rock layers of high mountains, even in the Himalayas. Psalms 104 describes how the mountains lifted and the valleys sank down, and also how the water streamed off the continents into the new ocean basins. The entire process certainly did not take millions of years, but in reality happened quite fast. When an oyster dies, its shell opens up. If an oyster is buried alive under very high pressure, or if it dies very suddenly, the shell remains closed. And on closer inspection, it is quite clear that the shells of this magnitude of fossilized oysters were all closed. In other words, they must have been alive when they were suddenly buried under a colossal mass of sediments. Let's have a look now at the effects of the biblical flood. As already mentioned, the bursting forth of the springs, the fountains, implies that the earth's surface was torn open. This surge of such an enormous amount of water in giant geysers caused tremendous upheavals on and under the surface of the earth. Earth's entire geological system was disrupted in the process. Tectonic plate movement commenced and was accompanied by massive earthquakes, which resulted in tsunamis. According to the catastrophic plate tectonics model, the ocean floor lifted relatively quickly with about 2,000 meters at the commencement of the flood because of an increase in temperature when the horizontal plate tectonic movement increased. large amounts of seawater would have flooded the dry land in the process. All of these movements in Earth's crust obviously caused cracks to form. Cold water flowed down these cracks into the boiling magma, which in turn led to powerful explosions of steam and streams of lava when thousands of volcanoes erupted. The top of seamounts were completely blown off in the process. And as explained, seamounts are extinct underwater volcanoes, and there are literally thousands of them under the sea today. Psalms 104:6-9. You clothed the earth with floods of water, water that covered even the mountains. At your command, the water fled. At the sound of your thunder, it hurried away. Mountains rose and valleys sank to the levels you decreed. Then you set a firm boundary for the seas, so they would never again cover the earth. If you ever needed a fantastic source of accurate historical information, try the Bible. From Psalms 104, it is quite clear that God drastically altered Earth's topography. This verse also implies that vertical earth movements were the dominant tectonic forces operating at the close of the flood. Flood waters continued to rise, and soon there was a global sea, because the waters covered even the highest mountains, mountains which could not have been very high before the flood, but we'll talk about this again shortly. As the waters rose, earthquakes, volcanic activity, and tectonic plate movement increased. This global water mass eventually flattened the pre-flood topography through erosion. After the water covered the highest mountains, God spoke and the waters hastened away. God set a firm boundary so that this water would never again cover the earth. His promise is repeated in Isaiah 54:9. This very same flood water is in today's oceans. All the mentioned forces and the relatively rapid tectonic plate movements contributed to certain areas being pushed up, the continental masses and the mountains, and other areas sinking down under the pressure of the water that streamed off the continents into the newly formed ocean basins, exactly as described in Psalms 104. This enormous and fast-moving body of water would have caused extensive erosion, which contributed to the basic formation of our landscapes today. The cooling of the new ocean floor would have increased its density, causing it to sink and thus receive the waters that stream off the continents. Under the weight of all this water, the basins began to stabilize. Interestingly, the resting place of the Ark in the mountains of Ararat, believed to be in a tectonic active region, which is believed to be the junction of three crustal plates. By the end of the flood, new continental land masses with new mountain ranges of folded strata arose from the water. We all know that rocks are not flexible at all, which is why the folded mountains must have formed quite rapidly while the sediments were still relatively soft. Otherwise, they would have completely disintegrated. Remember, folded mountains did not form from volcanic action. It wasn't soft lava, igneous rock, that hardened over time. Folded mountains consist of sedimentary rock. The still soft sediments were distorted and twisted and crumbled and folded in an effort to adapt to the enormous release of energy from all the aforementioned forces. Folded mountains can be clearly seen in the Swartberg Mountains. These photos were taken between Barrydale and Montague, and also show a vivid example of a disconformity. This is where a collection of vertical, horizontal, or sub-horizontal strata was eroded down before additional layers were deposited horizontally on top. So the layers were distorted and folded, and under immense pressure, erosion took place on top of these layers before a new horizontal layer were laid down on top of it. Other layers were uplifted or pushed up diagonally, sometimes up to 90%, as you can see in the following photos taken at Loskop Dam in Mpumalanga and Kamanasi in the Western Cape Province, South Africa. From all these immensely powerful movements, our present non-volcanic mountain ranges arose. Folded mountains are one of two types of mountains. The other type is volcanic mountains. Both came into existence more or less during the same time period, although volcanic activity continued on a much smaller scale than after the flood than during the flood. It is generally accepted that most of the mountain ranges were uplifted during the Pleistocene or late Pliocene. Both of these periods occurred shortly after the flood and therefore is in agreement with flood-related events. Mount Everest didn't exist before the flood, but formed when the Indian and Asian plates collided. This is also explained very well in the tectonic plates model. Today, Mount Everest is almost 9 kilometers high, while the Mariana Trench near Guam is almost 11 kilometers deep. Jacques Cousteau is well known for introducing us to the underwater world with his many documentaries that he made. He also helped develop the aqualung, which later developed into scuba, and he explained how, if it were possible to flatten the earth by evenly leveling the mountains and pushing up the basins, the world would be covered by water as deep as 2.7 kilometers. There is more than enough surface water around to cover the whole earth. The topography just needs to be more level. Remember, 70% of the earth's surface is still covered in water today. And keep in mind that the mountain building process could not have commenced before the flood because of the following reason. Genesis 7:20, the water prevailed 15 cubits upward and the mountains were covered. The New Living Translation says it a bit clearer, rising more than 22 feet, which is 7 meters above the highest peaks. Now, if the highest mountains of 9 kilometers above sea level today were covered by water that rose 7 meters higher than that during the flood, the world would forever have been covered with water because the continents would have been too deep under the water. The mountains had to have been lower than they are today, and there had to have been geological sinking and upheaval to make room for all that water and for us. The ocean today is much deeper than before the flood, because now it needed to serve as a reservoir for the massive amounts of water from the flood. It is quite clear that this was an act of an immensely powerful but yet infinitely merciful God. Job 38:10-11, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come, but no farther, and here your proud waves must stop. Dr. Jonathan Sarfati points out this irony. NASA scientists simply accept that there have been catastrophic floods on Mars that carved out canyons, although no liquid water is present today. They even refer to a Noachian epoch. Yet they refuse to accept that a global flood happened on Earth, where there is enough water, 70% of the Earth's surface, to cover the whole planet to a depth of 2.7 kilometers. You know, maybe if it wasn't recorded in the Bible, they would not have had any problem with a global flood on Earth. Let us now have a look at volcanic activity and its relation to the Ice Age. We rewind to the year 1883. Krakatoa was a volcanic island which was located between Java and Sumatra. The volcano had been raging for a few months when a lateral crack suddenly arose. Seawater streamed down the crack right into the main artery. This led to one of the most violent eruptions in the last 100 years and eventually led to the complete destruction of the island. Only a ring of small islands remained. There are literally thousands of extinct volcanoes located in the Pleistocene and even in the post-Pleistocene layers around the world, which indicates that they were still active close to the end of the flood and for a period thereafter while the water receded. This includes seamounts. Now, this illustration shows the global distribution of an estimated 60,000 seamounts. In general, air pollution doesn't remain in the atmosphere for very long. It eventually settles, or it's washed down by rain within a few weeks. However, when those pollutants, such as dust and ash, are shut up right into the stratosphere, which is located 16 to 48 kilometers high, they remain there for several years. Volcanoes are a natural cause of this. Sun radiation can be reduced by as much as 20%. It took 3 years for Krakatoa's dust and ash to settle, while causing a definite reduction in the world's temperature for almost 5 years. Thereafter, the dust had settled enough for the temperatures to recover. Can you even begin to imagine how terrible it must have been when thousands of volcanoes erupted at the same time? The huge amounts of dust and ash particles shooting into the stratosphere must have drastically influenced climatic conditions. The combination of dust, ash, and smoke in the stratosphere would have darkened the sky considerably, preventing the sun's rays from reaching the Earth. This caused the Earth to cool very rapidly. Secular scientists declare that volcanic activity and its effects, which continue for many years, may lead to the commencement of an ice age. The oceans were warmer after the flood due to the mixing of enormous amounts of hot water in contact with the underground lava that burst out of the underground fountains, the geysers. Tectonic plate movement began, and also because of the eruption of thousands upon thousands of volcanoes. Now, warm oceans lead to an increase in evaporation and therefore the formation of a large amount of warm moisture in the air. When warm moisture moves over a cold landmass, the warm air cools rapidly. Of course, the landmasses were cool because of volcanic dust and ash that blocked out the sun's rays, and an increase in moisture led to a higher percentage cloud cover. And in addition, the land surface was stripped bare of vegetation due to the flood and the resultant erosion. This bare land surface would have deflected any sunlight away. And there we have the perfect conditions, the perfect recipe for the development of an ice age. The ice age must have commenced after the flood and continued until the oceans cooled considerably and the climate began to stabilize. Most creation scientists believe that the ice age lasted for approximately 700 years. It happened only once, and it never covered more than one-third of the Earth's surface. Remember, a number of successive cold winters will not cause an ice age. A lot of moisture is required, and therefore an enormous amount of warm water, and at the same time, a cold land surface, as explained. Those conditions occurred only once in the history of the world. Evolutionists believe that many ice ages have occurred over the last 2 million years, only 5 of them being of major significance. But considering the unique conditions required for the commencement of an ice age, this claim is quite ridiculous. Amid all the volcanic eruptions and explosions, the poles froze and the animals in the far north were trapped and overwhelmed by the freezing cold conditions and ice. One of these animals was the giant mammoth, a type of elephant with long hair. Other animals that were suddenly frozen include bears, wolves, jackals, saber-toothed tigers, lynxes, horses, camels, goats, bison, sheep, rats. In other words, well-known animals. It appears as if the animals were exposed to severe stormy conditions and that some of them froze very quickly. Although 6 intact, frozen mammoth carcasses have been discovered, the majority of them show signs of decomposition before they were frozen and buried, including the presence of pupae of carcass-consuming flies and signs of scavenging from animals. Of the pristine frozen carcasses, some even had undigested food in their stomachs, and the majority of plant species identified in their stomach still grow in warm climatic conditions today. This provides further evidence of the change in climatic conditions that occurred, especially in northern Siberia and Alaska. The remains of hundreds of thousands of mammoths in northern Europe, Siberia, and Alaska have been discovered, the last two countries with an estimated 1 million mammoth remains. Some creation scientists have claimed that an extraordinary snap freeze is required to preserve the undigested stomach content. However, undigested stomach contents have also been discovered in non-frozen mastodon remains in Ohio, USA. The stomach of the elephant acts as a storage pouch for food, while the fermentation and digestion of the food mainly occurs in the cecum and colon. This is why the stomach contents of an elephant remains largely undigested. It is reasonable to assume that mammoths would be similar to elephants in this regard. This, in addition to the clear signs of decomposition as explained above, provides further evidence that a snap freeze is not required to explain this occurrence. In other cases, mammoths have been discovered of which the meat was still edible. Dogs ate it, and even some people, millions of years old. What do you think? Mammoth remains have been discovered as far as Mexico, indicating that they were probably well adapted to a wide variety of climatic conditions. Rock paintings of mammoths were made by people who obviously lived with them after the flood. How else would you draw something in such detail if you've never seen it before? Since the remains of these mammoths were discovered on top of the flood sediments, they had to have frozen sometime after the flood. Gale force winds would also explain why so many of them were discovered in groups. Very interesting results were obtained with carbon-14 dating on mammoths. We'll get to that. The freezing of the poles caused two things. Large amounts of water were suddenly locked in at the polar regions, and sheets of ice from the North Pole started sliding southwards off the continents. Scientists refer to this as the glacial period. Old Earth scientists declare that it took thousands of years for ice caps to form, and the mere fact that they exist serve as evidence of long ages. But then, as usual, another unpleasant surprise awaits them just around the corner. During the Second World War in 1942, a squadron of 8 P-38 Lockheed Lightning fighter planes took off from their base in Greenland en route to Britain. A snowstorm forced them to turn back. Although they had to do an emergency landing, they were all safe. Pat Epps, a wealthy entrepreneur, decided to retrieve the aircraft, but he could not find them at first. After 11 years of searching, they found the aircraft in 1988. This is 46 years after the landing. 1.6 kilometers from the original location, and buried under 75 meters of ice. The assumed burial depth of about 10 meters was likely based on the average precipitation in Greenland of about 32 centimeters per year. However, the southeast corner of the Greenland ice sheet is a relatively warm area with very high snowfall. Precipitation is actually over 70 centimeters per year. Such heavy precipitation gives us an idea of how fast snow and ice could accumulate on Greenland when the ice sheet was first developing during the Ice Age. Volcanism and other processes during Noah's flood warmed the oceans all over the Earth, causing increased evaporation and precipitation as explained earlier. So the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets would have grown rapidly in the post-flood period. There seems to be certain references to this ice age in the ancient book of Job, especially 38 and 37, who perhaps lived in its waning years. Job 37, 9-10. From the chamber of the south comes the whirlwind, and cold from the scattering winds of the north. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen. Job 38:29-30. From whose womb comes the ice, and the frost of heaven? Who gives it birth? The waters harden like stone, and the surface of the deep is frozen. In summary, as sure as there was a period of fast cooling, there was also a period of warming up after the volcanoes and the dust had settled. During the Ice Age, the sea level was much lower than it is today because so much water had been locked into the ice cover. Consequently, for a long time, land bridges were available whereby animals could distribute to other continents. With the Ice Age and the commencement of a final change in climate thereafter, many animals were unable to adapt and survive, and they went extinct. The melting of the ice caps and change in rainfall patterns caused wet regions to become arid, and even more animals became extinct because they were unable to adapt. Some, such as the mammoth, almost became extinct due to catastrophic events, climate change, and the resultant loss of habitat. The cataclysmic global flood event, followed by the relatively smaller catastrophic events or impacts of glaciers, volcanic activity, and subsequent drying, radically changed the appearance of our world to what we know today. In addition to the dinosaurs dying in large numbers, more than 50% of marine organisms died in the catastrophe. Throughout much of the world, most of the large mammals and many large birds became extinct at the end of the Ice Age. In North America, 70% of mammals weighing over 40 kilos disappeared, and about 75% from Eurasia. Australia lost a whopping 90% of its large Ice Age animals. Interestingly, Africa is the only continent where mass extinctions did not occur at the end of the Ice Age. The world today is a mere remnant of what it was before the flood. In the next lecture, we'll look at the logistics of the ark. How did the food, the water, and all the animals fit into the ark with Noah and his family? What did they eat after the flood? And various other interesting subjects. Thank you.